When you hear the word wetland, what do you imagine? A group of mangrove trees? Clumps of papyrus along the River Nile? If you're like most people who live in cities, it's normal if an image doesn't immediately spring to mind. What about if I say the word bog or marsh or swamp? It's more likely to conjure up images and probably not good ones. Bogs are liminal spaces, not quite water, not quite land. They can be difficult to walk in, and you're more likely to have been told a story when you're a child about a monster in a marsh than given a book entitled My First Wetland. This is because wetlands have a tendency to remain uncontrollable or wild. Living on wetlands requires special skills, which not everybody has. You can take a beautiful selfie with a tree in a forest, but on a peat bog, if you lose your concentration or footing, it can swallow you up in seconds. In the first three episodes of this series, we've been moving from the cultivated to increasingly wild spaces, from the garden, farmland, to woodlands. We have deep emotional connections to these spaces, and we try and look after them in various ways. But how do we treat places we barely think about and understand even less? In this episode of The Root of the Matter, we look at wetlands. Wetlands are varied spaces and can include anything from lowland fens and salt marshes to mangroves and peatlands. They are vital landscapes on which numerous plants and animals depend for survival. They're brilliant carbon sinks, burying carbon from decomposing plants in their soil before it can be released into the atmosphere. But despite all this, they're in decline all around the world. Why is that? Maybe it's got something to do with their reputation. Even though I live in a city, when I hear the word wetland, I think of home. Being Luo, I'm a daughter of the Nile. My ancestors over millennia followed the River Nile along wetlands to its source, Lake Victoria. Even our name comes from this history. Luo means to follow.
Especially in areas where precipitation is limited or temperatures are higher, like in the tropics, wetlands are extremely important. Ancient civilizations all grew around river valleys, lakes, etc. The Indus Valley in India, the Lower Nile.
That's Mordecai Ogada, an ecologist and writer involved in conservation policy and practice across Kenya. He describes how Luo peoples used papyrus swamps as an indicator for settlement.
There's a swamp where we'll get some papyrus for mats. Papyrus, that wetland is an important fish breeding area. They probably knew that there's good fishing around where you see papyrus swamps, where you see lots of fish eagles, kingfishers, etc. These are all indicators of a healthy and productive ecosystem. So people would settle around there and they'd look after it.
And one plant found there that traces a long lineage is papyrus.
All the way from the far north in Egypt, where it was used to make paper for the hieroglyphic scripts in ancient Egypt, coming down to Lake Victoria, there's a cultural importance around the use of papyrus to make mats which are used for sitting on, sleeping on, drying grain, drying fish, and even partitioning houses.
Yeah, I mean, I work with clay, I make pots, and so papyrus, we use it to fire. Traditionally, it's been something, you know, going back centuries, that papyrus leaves, when you use them to fire pots, it gives a completely different experience to the clay. And so we use the papyrus for that. So I was wondering if you had any other thoughts about kind of the cultural significance of wetlands and how people who have lived intimately with wetlands, there's a stewardship or a guardianship of those places.
The wetlands defined origins. When Luos are called people from the lake, or even when you're talking of specific areas, rivers are form the division between one area and another. Sometimes they're intra-ethnic boundaries, sometimes they're inter-ethnic boundaries, and they're places where either war or peace occurs, or trade. And that's the difference between Africa and the global north. We are people who are indigenous to the place where we live. We didn't come from anywhere. So these features, they define us. And it's even impossible to fully describe the importance of the lake to people who live around it. They're pretty much the lifeline in terms of ecosystem services, water itself, biodiversity, fisheries, as Lake Victoria is. Even recreation, whether we are talking about swimming and transport, people sailing on boats from one place to another, it's impossible to overestimate the importance of these wetlands because we live off them, really.
Even though, you know, I don't live by the lakeside, I feel like the lakeside is in me. It's always there with me, that sense of that connection. A lot of it, actually, funnily enough, is with dragonflies. Whenever I see dragonflies, I feel like, you know, there's the lake.
Yeah. If you look at Luos who live in Kenya, in Nairobi, for example, look at, you see that exodus that happens in December. People going home, Dala. It's like something people, many other people of other ethnic groups make fun of. Like, what are you guys going to do at home? Why don't you like go to Samburu for a few days as a holiday or something? But very few Luos can explain to you why it is they go home. It's the same thing when people die. That imperative to go and bury him in Nyanza.
Dala is the Luo word for home. And home means the wetlands on the shores of Nam Lolwe, which is what we've always called Lake Victoria. Historically, we based the rhythms of our lives around a wetland ecology. Wetland soil is highly fertile, which is why it got drained for agriculture. But our traditional management systems mean that we farmed for part of the year, had a fishing industry for a different season, and then moved along the Nile with our cows for another part of the year. Because I'm an anthropologist, you know, when I look at it from the cultural perspective, I surmise that when there was much more of a mixed economy, life was good in Luo wetlands. Because if I look at music, for example, and the vast number, I think we've got between 14 or 16 traditional instruments. We have many, many different words to describe music and our musical culture and our poetry and our theater is incredibly rich. So that speaks to me of people who had time.
You're absolutely right. It's a rich culture. And even if you talk about a word for eating, how many different words are there in Luo for eating, depending on what it is you are eating?
There's so many. There's, yeah, if you modo nyoyo, if you...
Mod, bango kuon, hadoringo. You know, this is richness. You're absolutely correct.
But there are increasing pressures to develop wetlands, to farm them intensively or to drain and build on them for so-called development. In the areas where this has happened, communities have witnessed the environmental destruction that has followed. It has affected not just their livelihoods, but also their lives. With less time on their hands, people are not able to have the cultural sort of festivals and engagement that they normally do with Nam Lolwe. This has had a devastating effect on their way of life. A few years ago, a multinational organization wanted to build a factory for agricultural processing in a wetlands area in Kenya.
They said, we are giving you jobs, we are piping water to your homes, but they made the crucial mistake of blocking people from the lake. And some say, okay, I've got a water tap at home, but hell, you're not blocking me from the lake. And it all went pear-shaped, it all went wrong.
Those who were critical of the local community's response didn't understand the wider context where the offer came in and threatened to fracture a culture that is a few thousand years old.
We are now doing engineering solutions to what we perceive as human problems, when what we should be doing is improving the resilience of people who have lived with those things we think are problems. We are trying to look at it as a resource. It's not a resource to be exploited. It is a jewel to be revered, to be used, to be lived with, to be looked after. We shouldn't see ourselves as its owners. We should see ourselves as its stewards.
Ever since I've been working on Everglades restoration issues, I've been like really intrigued by the history, particularly because of the concerns that we might be using the same mentality of the past and not learning from those mistakes.
Deanna Ampiere, who's based out of Florida, works as an organizing representative for the Sierra Club, which is a non-profit grassroots environmental organization. She's a big advocate for the restoration of the Everglades wetland, and in particular, keen to ensure that the voices of those most impacted by environmental issues are part of the conversation. One issue with the Everglades is toxic algae bloom. Starting in the 1830s, canals and dredges were put in different parts of the Everglades in an effort to drain them for agricultural use and also to create towns. In the process, Lake Okeechobee, a large water body in southern Florida, ended up being connected to the ocean.
It meant that every time that water flows into Lake Okeechobee, if there's no outlet, if there's no way for that water to flow south, the only place that then that water can go is east and west. And what happens? You have this huge amount of water, right, that comes, especially if you have a big rain event, you know, or a storm that comes in and that brings a lot of water into Lake Okeechobee.
And this fresh water with a different salinity level rushes towards estuaries and the coast. Add into the mix the runoff from nearby cattle ranches, septic tanks and agriculture, and you've got nutrient-laden water rich in excess amounts of phosphorus or nitrogen. This results in cyanobacteria, an avocado-coloured toxic algae, which sits like a carpet along the watercourse. Algae blooms are naturally occurring, but the scale and rate of growth of the blooms that appear is much faster than normal and can produce toxins that can have severe impacts on health.
The air that you breathe may carry some of those toxins. Some of the water that you drink or where you swim could potentially enter your body through the skin. There are some animals, some types of fish that sometimes retain those toxins more. So hypothetically, you know, some of those toxins can end up in the food that we eat.
But human health is more than just about what we eat. It encompasses livelihoods and access to adequate shelter, free from pollutants. For a group of people that had already been displaced from other parts of the United States, the Everglades served as a place of refuge.
The Seminole tribe and the Miccosukee tribe, who refer to themselves, and rightly so, as the unconquered people because they never surrender, they made, you know, the Everglades their home. The Miccosukee tribe, they live very deep into the wetter parts of the ecosystem. Both tribes are very much connected with the ecosystem. They depend on the wetlands for traditions, their culture.
One space within the Everglades that is key for the culture of the Miccosukee tribe is called the Tree Islands.
And they're parts of this ecosystem where water is flowing, where you have higher elevation. And that small differences in higher elevations means areas where they're able to cook, where they're able to sleep, where they're able to have ceremonies, and where they're able to bury their dead. We have lost a significant number of them because we have overflooded some parts of the ecosystem. If we put too much water in that ecosystem, it ends up drowning those tree islands. That means that they have then less access or no access at all to the areas where they practice their ceremonies or they cook or where they sleep and bury their loved ones.
Though this is happening less today, it's still an area of concern.
How do we make sure that we don't keep making mistakes that keep on destroying their culture, that keep on destroying those things that are important to their culture, such as the tree islands? And so a lot of the fight now is to protect, you know, what they still have.
One of the challenges with helping people to understand the importance of wetlands is our lack of ability to read landscapes and ecosystems holistically. When we see a landscape full of water, we treat the water as a problem and want to get rid of it, to get to the soil underneath, which we see as valuable.
When people talk about drain the swamp, it's a term that we hate it because that's the opposite of what we want to do here. We want to rehydrate this land.
We are now seeing the catastrophic effects of trying to break up the ecosystem by removing a key element of it. Take a cluster of mangrove trees on the shore of the sea. They're trees that live in salt water, and mangrove is a generic term for different species of trees that have similar features, which are multiple branches and shallow, twisted roots. These roots have to partially grow above ground because the soil that they grow in is waterlogged. Looking at them is like something out of a science fiction film. So how have mangroves been perceived historically? And what's been the impact of that perception on the landscape? The largest and most diverse mangrove forests can be found in Asia, with those in Indonesia being some of the tallest in the world, reaching up to about 45 meters in height.
Imagine that you are in West Papua in Indonesia, and these are some of the most pristine, undisturbed mangroves in the world. If you were stood in the middle of that mangrove, you wouldn't be able to see outside of the mangrove. It just goes on for miles and miles and miles. You would notice really deep mud, because this mangrove is at the entrance of several rivers. That substrate gives the foundation for a really rich mangrove ecosystem.
That's Dan Fries. He's an associate professor at the National University of Singapore. He's interested in researching mangroves, why they're important to us, the benefits they provide, and the threats that they face.
There's a saying that's attributed to a Thai fisherman called Madharan Wasi. And he said that if there are no mangroves, then the sea doesn't have any meaning. It's like having a tree without roots, for the mangroves are the root of the sea. Mangroves are a key foundation to so many things, and they're really at the root of many interactions between the environment and people. The mangroves are really resilient. They start out as this kind of tiny seedling trying to survive in this very dynamic coastal environment. But then they grow and they're able to give that resilience to others by protecting coastal communities, for example.
Mangrove coastlines protect local communities from natural hazards such as storms, and their sophisticated root systems help to improve water quality. But during the colonial era, Europeans saw mangroves as reservoirs of disease.
They were thought to produce bad air or miasma, and it was thought that this bad air was caused by decomposing vegetation and animals in the mangrove forest. Malaria was thought to come from this bad mangrove air. Before we knew anything about mosquito-borne diseases. You see these perceptions as reservoirs of disease written in ship logs from colonial ship captains around that kind of period. And it was only after that miasma theory was disproven, but even then, mangroves were still really strongly associated with mosquitoes and mosquito breeding. That led to huge areas of drainage and conversion of mangroves along many of our coastlines.
This is one of the legacies of colonialism that's gone on to have huge ecological impact around the world. In places like Indonesia and parts of East and West Africa, the colonial imagination of mangroves led to their destruction.
These are ecosystems that have had coastal communities associated with them for thousands or more years. If we look at traditional ecological and indigenous knowledges, it's been known for a very long time the real benefits that mangroves provide in terms of food and fuel and traditional medicines, but also in terms of other benefits and livelihoods that are associated with mangrove products.
Thankfully, some of this knowledge is starting to become more widely understood, and the perception of mangroves has improved.
Now the perception of mangroves is as a nature-based solution to climate change, or to help mitigate or offset our climate emissions by sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and trapping it within the ecosystem. So certainly we have a number of much more positive perceptions of mangroves now, particularly related to these benefits. But certainly some negative perceptions still remain, and they can still influence kind of how people view this really important ecosystem.
To me, wetlands are some of the most magical places that exist. But they matter much more widely. They're an important part of nature for the whole world. Even in different climates, like the UK, they're crucial ecosystems. They filter water and act as natural flood defences. But because they haven't been recognised for what they can provide, they've faced destruction.
If you destroy a massive reed bed, are you just destroying a bit of bog, or are you destroying the water purification, the carbon storage, the access to nature, the biodiversity, the genetic diversity, the medicines it might hold in things like the willow? In the UK and globally, wetlands are in a very bad place. We probably don't know how bad because we simply don't know what we've lost. The best guess for Sussex is that we've lost at least 80%. It's probably more like 90 or 95% of our original wetlands.
Fran Southgate is the Wilder Landscapes Advisor for Sussex Wildlife Trust and spends most of her time advising people on restoration projects.
So Sussex is quite unusual in as much as it has this band of green sand geology going through it, which is really acidic. And then it has another band of chalk, which is internationally rare and also very alkaline. And there's actually places in Sussex where those interact. So you've got this really incredible sort of acid to alkaline springs coming into the same place, and you get these wonderful fens and things. This wonderful little valley, I won't give the name away, it's got all these lovely chalk springs popping out into it. It's kind of like the land that time forgot. It feels prehistoric. It's got all these amazing dripping ferns and just the sound of bubbling water flowing over rocks, and it's got all these incredible bright red lichens and creepers and vines and trees that have fallen over, and it just looks really Jurassic almost. And in particular, things like floodplains, big floodplains where the water can sort of flatten out and slow down. That allows things like silt to drop out of the water column. And then you've got other things like reed beds. Their root systems trap soil and sediment anyway, but also they have lots of natural microbial action in their root systems, which help to break down some really quite serious pollutants.
Wetlands are a great defence against flooding because they store huge amounts of water that stops it from surging inland. The thing is, without being valued, they got dug up, drained and built over, leaving the houses that were built on them defenceless against flooding. More than 5 million homes, or one in six households in England, face this risk of flooding. Fran's been carrying out work that mimics natural flood management and has learnt a huge amount from the process.
I think it's taught me to accept change, which is something that as human beings we don't like change particularly, but everything changes on a daily basis. And in a wetland, you know, if you've got a really good dynamic wetland, it literally changes by the second, and you can watch it change before your eyes. Using water in your landscape, you can change something for the better overnight, but if you give it 100 years, you'll get something incredible.
They may not be as flashy as the Grand Canyon, but these wetlands here have biodiversity, and we just can't afford to lose them. Our future depends on them.
Because of the ever-enduring negative associations of them, when we think about the benefits that nature has to offer, wetlands don't immediately spring to mind. So we need to change this view with the wider public and help to shape their understanding.
They're not jars of preserve jam to be kept in their larder. They're living. They need to produce and renew and be stewarded. The biggest problem with the way we manage wetlands is that we try and manage them as something separate from people. Wetlands need to be managed holistically. We think we want to manage wetlands as discrete sort of chunks of something, yet water itself is a flowing medium. We need to revisit it in a way that's not about commerce, not about tourism, just a way that's about life. We must protect life, not biodiversity, not nature, not, we just protect life, which encompasses all that.
And it turns out that wetlands have the potential to protect all of life. The people who live in harmony with them are not just supporting their own lives and livelihoods, they're in effect supporting us all. Next week, in our final episode, we look at landscapes that human beings have ruined and abandoned. The wasteland. Are they really worthless and empty? Or left to her own devices, does nature return and flourish? It appears that nature does, and often in the most surprising ways. Thanks to all our contributors. Mordecai Ogada, Diana Umpiere, Dan Fries, and Fran Southgate. And if you'd like to dig deeper into the ideas we've covered here, go to the Wellcome Collection website, where you can also find a transcription of this episode. And if you're in London, head to the Rooted Beings exhibition, which is on until the end of August 2022. The Root of the Matter is a reduced listening production for Wellcome Collection. The producers are Alana Chance and Maylee Evans. Our music and sound design is by Alice Boyd, and I'm JC Niala.